Hi, I'm Carmen LaBerge. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Hello, friends. Welcome to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. Thank you for joining me for this part of your day. You are blessed in it, even in those moments when you don't necessarily feel blessed. We are blessed to know that God is, and we're blessed to know who God is, and we're blessed to know who we are because of who God is, and on and on and on. So let me just assure you today of the blessed reality of life. Even if it doesn't feel particularly blessed today, you're blessed. And sometimes those blessings aren't what we have been led by culture to believe, but they are always what we've been led by Christ to believe. So my encouragement today is that you and I would be surveying what's happening in our world, that we would actually be students of the times in which we live, and that we would bring the events of our days into conversation with the reality of who God is and what God is up to in terms of redeeming all of creation through the redemption of mankind through Jesus Christ. So our role and responsibility as ambassadors of Jesus Christ, ambassadors of the kingdom of heaven in the midst of the kingdoms of this world, is that you and I would be what I describe as conversational apologists, that we would enter into the conversations of the day in ways that honor Jesus, that we would get off of the sidelines and get God back into the conversation. So that's what we're going to do here, not only today on Connecting Faith. It's what we do here on Connecting Faith every day. So at the end of every hour, I do something called the Connecting Point. Today's Connecting Point is going to be about Aretha Franklin and her life and how you might see it as inspiration for your own. So don't miss that. But between now and then, I'm going to have a conversation with Glenn Stanton. Glenn works for Focus on the Family. He also writes for The Federalist. And he and I are going to talk about really the sort of the status of Christians in the culture today and how we are characterized and mischaracterized by those in what we would describe as sort of the elite media. We're going to have that conversation. He and I are also going to talk about unfolding events in Colorado and California related to religious liberty. And then I'm going to have a conversation today with Lee Strobel. You recognize the name Lee Strobel from The Case for Christ, but Lee has a new book out called The Case for Miracles: A Journalist Investigates Evidence for the Supernatural. So don't miss those two conversations, which are coming up today on Connecting Faith. So let's jump into a couple of headlines here at the start of the hour. Here's really what I think about each day when I prepare to come and chat with you. I think about, all right, what's some news we can use in our conversational apologetics? So there's all kinds of news stories out there. There are all kinds of conversations taking place around us. Where's the news we can use in terms of getting God back into the conversations of the day? Well, in some stories, God is right in the middle of it, sometimes mischaracterized, sometimes maligned, but right in the thick of it. And so I'm going to return today to probably the biggest story of the week in terms of the church in America. And that would be the victim stories related to the revelations in the grand jury report issued in the investigation related to six Roman Catholic dioceses in the state of Pennsylvania. And so if you're not already familiar with this story, I believe we all need to become familiar with this story, in part because the Vatican has now responded. And I think that we will be hearing more about this, not less. It's not going away. The victim stories are genuinely horrendous. And those victim stories are only going to probably fill the news in increasing cycles over the course of days and weeks, months, and even years. And why is that? Well, because we're talking about a minimum of 1,000 children who were victimized, but possibly many, many multiples of that. And we're also talking about a reality that's certainly not confined to the geography of Pennsylvania and these six dioceses that are featured in this particular investigative report. We are very likely talking about turning to one another and saying in the midst of a conversation, that's very serious and very soulful, we need to be asking this question. Did anything like that ever happen to you? We need to ask it of every person. We need to ask that question of one another. We need to turn to one another and we need to say, did anything like that ever happen to you? And we need to be prepared to process the answer to the question if the answer is yes. And because in all likelihood, that victim has never told anyone else because they've never been asked. And there's never been a moment in time when it felt safe to say, I had a similar experience when I was a little kid. And so let me just invite you to go there. Let me invite you into the ministry moment that I believe stands before each and every one of us after these revelations related to these 300 or more predator priests in six dioceses in Pennsylvania. And we dare not imagine that it was confined to the geography of that place. So from there, I want to turn to a story out of Canada that is related. I think that people have wondered why so many people have the church. And I lift up the story from Canada because it's a little bit easier to do that than to point to churches in our own communities. It's a little bit easier to point, to churches across the border. So let's just think about this. In the 1950s, 95% of the population of Quebec, 95% of the population of Quebec went to Roman Catholic Mass every week. 95% of the population of the city of Quebec went to Catholic Mass in the 1950s every single week. 5% of the people in Quebec do so today. And so we're talking about a little over 50 years in terms of a period of time, closer to like 60 years. That is not just a sharp drop in church attendance. That means that there are hundreds and hundreds of vacant churches, like literally empty churches. And so what's happening to those empty churches, these towering old crosses that still dot the province, which have become, in this particular article, monuments to the past, is that these pieces of property are being converted from sacred to, at a minimum, secular use, and in many cases, very profane use. And in this particular article that I'm drawing from today, which is from the Montreal Dispatch, and it was reposted in the New York Times, where churches have become temples of cheese, fitness, and eroticism. Dateline is Montreal. The lead is this. For generations, parishioners whispered their sins in the dark wooden confessional booths of Notre Dame, an imposing Roman Catholic church in Montreal. But on a recent day, the edgy Quebec comedian Sugar Sammy was being filmed inside one of the confessional booths, the latest celebrity confessional on a talk show, which, if you translate it from the French, is the church is packed. There is a St. Jude church here in Montreal's Plateau, Montreal Royal neighborhood, where that's now a gym, and they describe what's taking place there. And a person in the gym saying this: "Look, my grandmother was a happy Christian. She's probably just glad I'm spending time in church, even if I'm working on my biceps, not my soul." So his grandmother was a person of faith. His mother, maybe not a person of faith. And clearly he is not a person of faith at all. The stories that are contained in this New York Times piece about what's going on in these church facilities that have now been sold and are being used for non-sacred purposes, I think it's important for us as Americans to actually look at what's happening across our northern border, because this is where, frankly, it's headed. And not just for Roman Catholic churches, but for other churches where, in places where we thought that steeples and smokestacks used to be the things that you could see when you drove into a particularly industrial town in America, those smokestacks no longer spewing forth steam. And those steeples now on tops of buildings that are restaurants and bars and theaters and every manner of other thing. And so I want us to consider that. And I want us to consider what the renewal of the church in our own communities might look like and what the church is really for and what it's about. There's a statement, again, in this New York Times article that I found to be particularly troubling. There's a Roman Catholic gentleman who is the director of a theater in one of these former churches. And he's asked, you know, doesn't this seem sacrilegious? Doesn't this seem like something that we shouldn't be doing in a church? And he says, look, I don't feel any taboo in transforming a church into a theater. After all, we are remaining true to the church's mission, serving the community. So therein, my friends, lies the depth of confusion. Mr. St. George, who is quoted there, is a Roman Catholic. He was raised in the church, and he thinks the mission of the church is simply to serve the community. And if at this point in time, what serves the community is to have a theater, which if I were to describe to you what happens in this theater, it's not G-rated. The challenge for us is that we have lost sight of what the mission of the church actually is. And once we have lost sight of what the mission of the church is, then what happens in the church, well, frankly, just denigrates from one generation to another. So we're going to talk about Christian witness. We're going to talk about the view that the culture has of Christians. Part of that conversation is coming up next with Glenn Stanton. Glenn works for Focus on the Family. He also writes for The Federalist as a senior contributor there. And it's a piece in The Federalist that caught my attention and I wanted to share with you today. The piece in The Federalist at Federalist.com is entitled New York Times Hit Piece. And it's about Mike Pence and anti-Christian bigotry made quite plain and simple. All right, friends, that's up next here on Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. We'll be right back. I need help. Hey, friends, you are listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. Welcome back. Joining me now in conversation is Glenn Stanton. Glenn is on staff with Focus on the Family, a ministry partner with us here at Faith Radio. And he also writes for a website called The Federalist. And if you're not familiar with The Federalist, let me just say that Glenn and others are writing there and doing good work and helping us understand what's happening in the culture and applying the mind of Christ to those matters. So, Glenn, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Well, thank you, Carmen. Good to be with you.
Well, it's great to have you. So, without me spoiling what you say in this piece, the New York Times basically wrote a hit piece on Vice President Mike Pence. Why don't you share with our listeners sort of what was in their piece, and then we'll talk about how we as Christians should respond to that.
Yeah, well, thank you. It was really quite stark, and it was Frank Bruni. It's one of their columnists, and he has a long, long history of being very vicious toward the Christian faith. But here's what he said, and you know where he's coming from generally. So he says there is something worse than Donald Trump, and the reason that we may not want to work on the impeachment of Donald Trump is that, you know, quote unquote, as bad as he is, there is something still worse that would take his place, and that is Vice President Pence. And the evidence for that is, you know, not that Mike Pence has ever cheated anybody or killed anybody or done anything. It is that he has a Christian faith that he takes very seriously. Seriously, that was the piece. So, I mean, you look at the left and you think, you know, and many in our own community, I mean, fairly like, okay, as problematic as President Trump is in many ways, and, you know, the left has just gone crazy and apoplectic, he's saying there is still something worse, and that is a politician who has a serious faith. He calls his Christianity regressive and repressive, that he wants to force his Christian beliefs on the whole nation. He calls Vice President Pence, quote, a holy terror. I mean, it's just absolutely remarkable. So that's what quickly compelled me to start clicking on my keyboard and you know, hammer something out on this to just address how ridiculous that is.
Right. So I would like to talk about one particular charge, and that is that Mike Pence is a religious zealot. Because I got to tell you, Glenn, if Mike Pence is a religious zealot, I am too. And I'm married to a zealot, and we're raising zealots, and every day I take to zealotry here on the air. I mean, if being a person of faith in the way that Mike Pence is a person of faith, if that is religious zealotry today, he's got a lot of company.
Well, we have to think about this just even in terms of rhetoricalness. Now, see, a zealot is always those people. You know, you never call, like, Martin Luther King, was he a religious zealot? Well, yes, he was, because he was just unapologetic about his faith, and his faith is what caused him to go out into society and say, hey, America, we are involved in a great sin, and we have to change our behavior. But, you know, in another sense, no, Martin Luther King is not a zealot, because people like Frank Bruni, correctly, you know, agree with what Martin Luther King and, you know, and other folks, we can think of examples like that. A zealot is somebody merely who has a serious Christian faith that you tend to disagree with. So as I say in the article, that word zealot is a very slippery kind of term that is offered with just incredible self-righteousness. And it is simply more indicative of the position that the caller is coming from. A zealot is always those people over there that we don't like, regardless of what it is they may be saying.
Okay, so let's examine Mike Pence's faith a little bit, because one of the things that you say in your piece, and again, friends, my conversation partner today is Glenn Stanton. He is the director of Family Formation Studies at Focus on the Family. He's also a writer for The Federalist, which you can find at federalist.com. The piece we're looking at today is the New York Times hit piece on Mike Pence, is anti-Christian bigotry plain and simple. And so one of the things you say in here is Pence's original and most damning sin is that he's a Christian who actually believes what Christians actually believe. Talk with us about, like, what kinds of Christianity are okay for mainstream media like Bruni, and those kinds of Christianity that are then not okay.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, the kinds of Christianity, first, that are not okay. And you know, what Bruni and those elites that live in their, you know, quite literally ivory towers, what they don't understand is there are millions of good Americans that, you know, shop at Walmart and drive minivans and, you know,
you're
go
describing
to
my life, man. You're totally describing my life. Yeah.
But they believe that God is involved in the affairs of man, that he calls us to a level of righteousness, that God does have sexual standards, that miracles exist, that, I mean, you know, contrary to, you know, those ladies on The View, that you can speak to God and God can speak to you, not audibly necessarily, but, you know, unmistakably you hear that, and it's not a mental illness, that miracles happen, you know, that sin is real, that there was a real man named Jesus that actually died on a cross one day, and he was put in the grave and he was resurrected. All he is saying is people like that are zealots. The other is, you know, that the two-parent family, mom and dad, being married, raising their own kids, that is a social virtue, and that's what God puts in place. These are the things that Frank Bruni in the New York Times are saying are more dangerous than who Donald Trump is. I mean, the rhetoricalness of that, the over-the-topness of that is just laughable.
Yeah, and then I think the other, you know, sort of to be, well, I don't know, I was going to say to be fair, but I'd have to be more than fair in granting this. But the fear that Bruni seems to have, and I have heard this in other places with respect to other politicians who are Christians, is that what Mike Pence and others want is a theocracy. Can we talk about just how far we are from any concept of theocracy? When we're talking about Christians serving in positions of public service?
Well, it's interesting because Bruni says that with Trump, we have a kleptocracy, which, you know, is he stole the leadership of this nation. Now with Pence, you get a theocracy. And any time there has been anybody involved in public politics that has a serious faith, you have this phrase come up. These people want to cast upon us a theocracy. Now, a theocracy is basically the government is run by Christians in Christian ways, and everybody will force to be Christians. I mean, it is so utterly ridiculous that, I mean, first of all, there's no Christian leaders that, first of all, want that. And never have we ever become, you know, close to even approaching that kind of thing. And that phrase is just thrown out with such irresponsibility and just, I mean, it's not even intelligent. And so that's what we see. And when people hear that, like, oh my goodness, Vice President Pence and, you know, other Christian leaders that are involved in politics, they want to, you know, bring in a theocracy. It's just beyond ridicule and ridiculousness. It's just silly. I mean, it's make-believe and it's imaginary.
All right, let's change gears here for a second. What are you working on at Focus on the Family? What should people know about in terms of family formation? What's going on?
Oh my goodness, we're constantly busy on all kinds of things. One of the things that I'm working on lately, I mean, really too, is just the whole gender issue. This idea, do male and female matter? And this whole effort to say that, no, male and female do not matter, and in fact, they're just merely illusionary, and that we can be one of any, you know, 65 genders and things like that. And we need to understand that in terms of family formation, the family is built upon the distinction and the value and the power, if you will, of male and female. So this whole gender issue is not just nearly the latest skirmish in the culture war. It is really an attack upon the very image of God, because God tells us in the first chapter of Genesis, let us create man in our image according to our likeness. And then not just man, humanity, but male and female. It says, in the image of God, he created them, male and female. So male and female are the only parts of creation that show forth the image and likeness of God. Okay? So there is, if you will, a divinity, a specialness, a holiness, if you will, of what male and female is. And we're having this movement today that essentially is saying what God has put into male and female, don't pay any attention to that. God is actually lying about what he says about that. And male and female don't really mean anything. And we have to know that the people that are pushing this are not demonic by any sense, but there is a demonic force behind this. And I don't say that in a sensationalistic way, but when you start saying, no, what God says he is and what he represents in society, that's not true. There's only one.
All right, we're
going
to have to leave it.
That.
We're going to have to leave it right there. Friends, this is Glenn Stanton. I'm Carmen LaBerge. This is Connecting Faith. Next up, Lee Strobel.
Don't you give up.
Hey, friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. Joining me now is Lee Strobel. He and I are going to talk about his new book, The Case for Miracles. You know Lee. He's a New York Times bestselling author. And he has trained his investigative insights on the issue of whether or not it's actually credible to believe that God actually still does stuff, like God does intervene and interact in people's lives today. Lee, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Thanks, Carmen. Always great to chat with you.
So just a couple of days ago, we talked with your colleague and co-author, Mark Middleberg, about the project that you guys have been working on that's now available to people to help each one of us make our own case for Christ. You want to say something about that before we talk about The Case for Miracles?
Sure. Yeah, that's a six-week video-driven curriculum. We've taken scenes from the movie The Case for Christ that kind of illustrate good practices in evangelism, and we teach also about why we believe what we believe, and we're hoping it equips Christians to be able to articulate their own faith, why they believe what they believe, and their own story of how God has changed their life. So we're excited about that.
All right, so if you guys are listening and you want to go back and learn more about that, just 2 days ago here on Connecting Faith, so that would be the August 15th podcast, and you could go to myfaithradio.com to the Connecting Faith page, and you could go back and listen to my conversation with Mark Middleberg about the way we make our case for Christ and the curriculum related to that. So, Lee, let's talk about the case for miracles. A journalist investigates evidence for the supernatural. It's pretty provocative. It actually starts with what I will describe as an unlikely interview. Tell people
yeah.
how the book opens.
Yeah, you know, I started out by going to the most famous skeptic in America, Dr. Michael Shermer, who's editor of Skeptic Magazine. And I said, you know, build your best case against miracles. And so I gave him the opening of the book, three chapters, to really talk about why, as a skeptic, he does not believe in God or that God still does miracles today. And I did that because I just think his case is so weak, and I wanted people to be able to see, you know, give me your best shot and to evaluate it and to see that, you know what, it's a weak case. It doesn't stand up to the remainder of the book, which looks at the affirmative case that God is still in the miracle business today.
So here's what I like about just simply the format of the book, and that you actually allow the skeptic the very beginning. You allow three chapters at the very beginning for the skeptic to make his own argument. Lee, I think that is so instructive for every Christian who's listening who wants to be trained and equipped as a conversational apologist in the world today. We have
to listen. People get afraid. They think, oh, there must be some knockdown argument that skeptics have, and they kind of shrink back because they're afraid of what objections might be presented. But when you face it head on and you look at their arguments, you realize, wow, it's full of misconceptions. It's full of misunderstandings. It's based on faulty information, and it just does not stand up to scrutiny.
So then, because, you know, you're really a journalist, you went and you interviewed scholars to see what they could offer in terms of answering these atheist objections. So what did you find?
Well, what I found was a couple of things. Number one, I found that miracles are a lot more common than people think they are. Number two, we have a lot better documentation for miracles than a lot of skeptics suppose. And, you know, so those were kind of surprises to me. You know, because as a skeptic and atheist myself, I came to faith because of the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus primarily. And so I believed in that miracle. I believe, based on the gospel accounts, that Jesus performed miracles. Even his opponents conceded he did. They just didn't like the fact he did them on the Sabbath. So I believe that, but I wondered, is God still doing miracles today? We hear these reports, we see things on TV, we wonder, is this authentic? Is it fakery? Is it fraud? Is it misunderstanding? Is it misdiagnosis? And so I spent 2 years investigating the supernatural and was astounded when I did it to find that miracles are more common, that 38% I found of Americans believe that they've had at least one miracle in their life they can only explain as an intervention from God. And the documentation for the miracles, that we have peer-reviewed articles in secular scientific medical journals that document something is going on supernaturally. I have cases that I talk about in the book, including a woman named Barbara Snyder, who's healing from multiple sclerosis, it just blows your mind, and yet thoroughly documented from eyewitnesses, from physicians, from medical records, and so forth.
Okay, so let's go from there to deal with the really hard question. Because as soon as you and I start down the list of miracles we've experienced and stories of miracles in the lives of those close to us, and we've seen their lives transformed, then there are those who are saying, well, then if that's true, why didn't I get the miracle I asked for? Why, if God can intervene, why does he only do so selectively?
Yeah, and that's the big question. You're exactly right. And I knew I couldn't write a book on miracles without addressing this issue of what about miracles that don't happen? because as you may know, my wife suffers from a medical condition that has her in pain every single day. For 20 years, she's been in pain, and she'll be in pain the rest of her life unless God does a miracle and heals her. She's had an incurable condition, and yet he hasn't healed her. And so you wonder, why not? So what I did is I went to a philosopher with a PhD who's a professor at Denver Seminary, Douglas Grotius, and so who understands all of the philosophical reasons for this. But Douglas's wife, when I interviewed him, was dying of a brain condition that later claimed her life. Just a few weeks ago, she actually died. But for many years, she had been suffering from this brain condition that was making her just totally disabled. And they prayed for a miracle that didn't come. And so I interviewed him about how he deals with that. And I tell you, Carmen, it was the most profound interview I think I've ever conducted, because here is a man with great intellect but also personal experience and suffering. And I thought his advice on it, his insights on it, this question of unanswered prayer, were so profound that I think anybody wrestling with that issue really needs to read that chapter.
Okay, friends, so I'm talking with Lee Strobel. We're talking about The Case for Miracles, A Journalist Investigates Evidence for the Supernatural. You can find it anywhere books are sold. Amazon is obviously the easiest place to get it. So I just, while we were talking, I Googled the word miracle and news that's just popping today, right?
Yeah.
And so I get literally thousands of places in which the word miracle is used across, just across every cultural platform you could imagine. Talk with us about the word itself and how maybe we as Christians can reclaim it.
Yeah, that's a great comment. You're right. Miracle is a word we throw around. Lots of people throw it around. But what does it really mean? What's a good definition of miracle? I think the best definition comes from Richard Pertill, who was a professor of philosophy, who said a miracle is an event brought about by the power of God that is a temporary exception to the ordinary course of nature for the purpose of showing that God has acted in history. So in other words, where people make a mistake, I think David Hume, the famous skeptic from the 1700s, said that miracles violate the laws of nature. The laws of nature cannot be violated, therefore miracles are impossible. But he misunderstands, he defines miracles as a violation of the laws of nature. It's not. I'm holding in my hand a pen right now. If I were to drop this pen, it would hit the floor. The law of gravity says it will hit the floor. But if I drop this pen and you reach in and grab it before it hits the floor, you're not violating the law of gravity. You're not overturning the law of gravity. You're merely intervening. And so a miracle is God's temporary intervention in the laws of nature that he created. And if we have good evidence that God did create the universe, and I have a chapter in my book from a noted physicist, a PhD from UCLA, a professor at a major secular university, who argues from the evidence of science that there is a supernatural creator. And if there is, it would be like child's play for him to intervene in the laws of nature that he himself created and to create a virgin birth or to create or to walk on water or whatever. So I think that misunderstanding about the definition of miracle leads to a lot of confusion about what it's really about.
So, Lee, maybe as a walk-off question here, for you to be able to tell a story about your own experience in writing this book and digging around in all of this, you've now examined this from all sides. What did you personally come away with?
I came away so encouraged that miracles are more common than we thought. If we open our eyes to them, that they're more, 38% of Americans, that'd be 94 million miracles that have taken place just in America. And if you were to wipe out 99% as saying they're just misunderstandings or something, that still leaves a million miracles. So they're more common. And the ones that I document in the book with medical records from the Mayo Clinic, from physicians, from eyewitnesses, are so breathtaking, so amazing, that we're currently working on a movie based on this book that'll be coming out next year. And we're going to have to put a disclaimer at the beginning of the movie saying the miracles you see in this film are true because they're so astounding. You think, well, that can't possibly have happened. And yet we have such strong documentation for these things. And we're going to actually create a website where people who see the movie can go to the website and see all the documentation that backs up these miracles that God has performed.
Okay, that's so cool. I mean, I love the layers of invitation. Like, right. So let's just let me just invite listeners right now. If you have a miracle story and you're saying to yourself, hey, I've got a miracle story, I would personally love to hear it. So you can email me, Carmen@myfaithradio.com, or you can text your contact information and I'll get back with you. You can text it to 877-93-2484. That's our studio line. So that's 877-93-FAITH. 933-2484. Text me, tell me you've got a miracle story, or email me, Carmen@myfaithradio.com. Lee Strobel would love to hear it too. I promise to pass them along to him. Or you can hit him up on Twitter. He's at Lee Strobel. We're talking about his new book, The Case for Miracles. Also want to highlight again, Lee, because I've got you, that you and Mark Middleberg have this new 6-session study. Make your case for Christ. Friends, there's a DVD so that you can like host it in your own home with a group of people. It's they've done the work for you in terms of facilitating a small group conversation about these things. And then there's a study guide for each participant so that, you know, you can engage with the material yourself and actually get to the place where you can do what Lee has done. Lee makes the case for Christ in his own book and in the movie by the same name. But this curriculum helps you and I do the same thing, helps us make our case for Christ. And it's just called Make Your Case for Christ. And so, Lee, thank you so much for
sure.
The Case for Miracles. Thank you for all that you're doing at Houston Baptist. And thank you for equipping us with really good studies like Make Your Case for Christ.
Well, thank you, Carmen, for the show that you do that exposes so many people to why we believe what we believe. It's valuable stuff.
Well, you're so kind. And we'll talk with you again soon. We look forward to the movie. I can't wait to see it.
Awesome.
All right, friends. Hey, you're listening to Connecting Faith. When we come back, I'll be making the connecting point. I'm Carmen LaBerge. Hey, friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. All right, for those of you who just heard my conversation with Lee Strobel and you were thinking to yourself, does she have books? Can I enter in a contest today, a drawing to get a copy of The Case for Miracles? Yes, in fact, you can. It slipped my mind. I'm so sorry. I didn't say so. So if you would like to enter a drawing for a copy of Lee Strobel's new book, The Case for Miracles, you can either call the studio line, 877-933-2484. That's 877-93-FAITH. Or you can text the same number. Now, if you text us, you got to give us your name and your email address, because that's how then we're going to communicate with you. Or maybe your mailing address. I think we have to have it all in order to get a book to you if we pull your name in the drawing. So if you want a book, communicate with us. If you email me at Carmen@myfaithradio, again, I need your name and your physical mailing address in order that we could ship you a book. So you can text or call 877-933-2484, or you can email me, Carmen@myfaithradio.com. And enter a drawing for a copy of one of the books that we have, which is The Case for Miracles by Lee Strobel. So there you go. Sorry I didn't mention it when I was talking with him. Sometimes, you know, I get kind of excited and I forget what I'm doing. So there you go. I know that never happens to anyone who's listening right now. Okay, so this is supposed to be the connecting point. So here's my connecting point today. I want to talk about Aretha Franklin. I want to do so in a way that not only celebrates her life, but acknowledges that, you know, her life was complicated. I want to honor the fact that she honored God and she believed, as a person of faith, not only raised in the pastor's home, but really vibrantly talked about the reality of the gospel in terms of what she was doing in her own life, seeking to sing about things that she believed were true. And hopefully making it all beautiful, which I think, you know, she did. She achieved all that. Now, she also, at a very young age, had two babies out of wedlock. And she had failed marriages, and she was honest about abusive relationships that she found herself in. And so when we look at people like Aretha Franklin and we say to ourselves, you know, well, she got to sing for presidents, and she, you know, President Bush honored her with the Medal of Freedom, and she sang for President Obama very recently at the Kennedy Center. You know, this is, you think of her as being literally on the top of the world, but she was a person who was acquainted with suffering. She was a person acquainted with pain. She was a young African-American woman in the 1960s. And for you and I to think that, you know, everything that she ever had or did or touched turned to gold, she was also a person who along the way, because of the way a contract had been written, you know, she found herself in great poverty. So I think that when we think about what our lives say to other people, I want you to consider today in the conversations about Aretha Franklin, what does her life say to you? You know, what are the choruses that play in your mind that you hear in her voice? When she was she didn't give a whole lot of interviews, but in one interview that she gave that stands out in my mind to NPR, it was a number of years ago. And one of the questions that was asked was, you know, when you moved from gospel to soul, and she actually interrupts the interview and she's like, whoa, I never moved from gospel. I take gospel with me everywhere I go. I took the gospel with me into soul and or into pop. And so I think that when we, you know, we think of like crossover artists, right? And they're going to move from a Christian platform to something that we consider other than a Christian platform. We got to say to ourselves, you know what? If they're Christians, the gospel's going with them as they are seeking to advance it always and in all ways, maybe into new terrain that has not recently been tilled out there in the culture. But if it's a Christian that's out there doing it, then it's Christian at some level, right? And so I want to encourage us, I want to encourage each and every one of us to consider, even as you cross over from whatever explicitly Christian thing you're up to things that seem kind of less Christian, right? Like your vocation or your vacation, like the gospel goes with you. That's what it means to be a Christian. We don't live a life that's all chopped up like pie, and one slice of the pie is, you know, the Christian part of the pie, and one slice of the pie is, you know, our family part, and we govern that, or our physical part, and, you know, Jesus doesn't have any say in how we treat the temple of his Holy Spirit now. You know, Jesus, you know, stay out of those things. You know, stay out of my snack drawer or whatever. Like, Jesus is either Lord or he's not. There's no way of segregating sections of your life off and saying, Jesus, you get this part of my, you know, I've divided this up and here's your part of my life that you're allowed to govern. That is ridiculous. That's not lordship. That is you actually asserting lordship over Jesus. And so if indeed Jesus is Savior and Lord, then the gospel goes with you because you are a person who is not only covered by Jesus Christ, you're possessed of him. Like it's literally he's living in there by the power of the Holy Spirit, taking every one of your thoughts captive to his lordship and then bringing because the Holy Spirit, if we are willing to cooperate with the Holy Spirit, will bring us moment by moment into ever greater conformity with who Christ is. So we actually become more Christ-like as the moments and days and years wear on. So if you think to yourself, you know what, I was most Christian the moment I became a Christian, and since then I've kind of been backsliding, okay, today's the day. Today's the day to actually say, you know what, I'm not just going to rely on Jesus as my Savior, like a wonderful insurance policy against going to hell. I'm actually going to acknowledge that Jesus is Savior and he is Lord. And he is Lord over every part of my life. And there's nothing that I am going to seek any longer to withhold from his lordship. I'm not going to try to keep some part of my life over here under my own governance. Because by the way, you know, if we're perfectly honest with ourselves, if we look at that part of our lives that we've tried to maintain under our own governance, let's just all admit, it's a mess. It's a mess. Better for God to be governing that part of our lives through Jesus Christ than to be seeking to retain our own sense of autonomy from Him in that area of life, whatever it is. And for some of us, it's our social media habits. For some of us, it's our language. I had a conversation with a colleague earlier today, and she was going to get this really, like, incredible, lucrative bonus if she booked a particular client by a particular point in time. And so she's been obviously spending some time with that person and talking with them. And in reaction and response to something that what I would consider minor interruption into their conversation. So another person briefly interrupted the conversation that he was having with my friend. And this individual's response to that interruption communicated to my friend, this is not only somebody I'm not going to try to book in this window in which I'd get a bonus. I cannot represent this person. I cannot in good conscience represent a person who says they're a Christian and then talks like that and treats another image bearer of God like I just saw this person treat this random individual. So why do I bring that up? Because you and I as Christians, there are going to be sacrifices that we have to make every single day. I mean, even if it's, sacrificing the opportunity to have a client that would produce income for you or whatever. But there are choices and sacrifices that you and I have to make every single day in every part of our lives if we are genuinely going to live as ambassadors of the kingdom of heaven in the midst of the kingdoms of this world. Every single moment, there's an opportunity to make a decision either for or against Christ, either representing Him, representing Christ, full of grace and full of truth, to the world that He so loves and came to redeem, or misrepresent Him. So you and I are carrying the name, the label, Christian, into the world. That means that no matter if we cross over from this to that, from one position to another, from one group of people to another, from one environment to another, the gospel goes with us one way or another. The gospel either authentically goes with us and people begin to see and understand who God is through our witness and testimony, or because they know we are Christians, or we say we are Christians, and then they see and experience in our lives that which is contrary to who Christ really is, what they get is a misrepresentation of Christ. And so the gospel goes with us either positively or negatively, one way or another, either drawing people toward Christ or repelling people from Him. Plenty of stories this week about how people have been repelled from God by the actions of so-called Christians. Let's not in any way contribute to that. Let's be people who get out there into the world and into the conversations of the day in ways that honor Jesus and in ways that share with people the goodness, the beauty, and the truth of the gospel. All right. I appreciate those of you who have already taken advantage of the opportunity to text in for a copy of The Case for Miracles. I appreciate Dustin from North Dakota and Geraldine from Bruce, South Dakota, and Bob from Ballatin, Minnesota. I just love seeing where people are listening from. And so glad to know you guys are out there listening. If others of you want to get in the drawing for the Case for Miracles book, you can do so by calling or texting 877-933-2484. That's 877-933-2484. Or you can email me, Carmen@myfaithradio.com. Hey, let me encourage you to go back and not only share today's show with somebody else from myfaithradio.com, but go back and listen to the podcast from the 15th. That was 2 days ago, where I talked with Mark Middleberg, Lee Strobel's colleague, about Make Your Case for Christ. All right, friends, literally all the time we've got here today. Have a great weekend and God bless. This is Connecting Faith, and I'm Carmen LaBerge. Thanks for listening to this conversation from Connecting Faith. These podcasts are available because of listener support. You can make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend to grow the impact of Connecting Faith. Also, take a moment to subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player and never miss a conversation.